This is an ABC podcast.
Hey there, Ange McCormack with you for Hacks Podcast. Should students from a super rich private school get vaccinated before someone working in a nursing home? That's a real thing that's happened in Sydney. Coming up, we'll talk about how the vaccine rollout's going and if the queue system is working fairly. Plus, America's fastest woman has been disqualified from the Olympics because she had weed in her system. So, should a drug that slows you down be a banned substance? Those stories are coming up on the Hack Podcast.
Hack. When you lose a sight, they're gone forever. You can no longer use it. You can no longer learn about it. It's irreplaceable.
On Triple J.
The past few days, we've been talking about NAIDOC Week's theme, which is Heal Country. So, how can we heal country when sacred Indigenous sites are being destroyed? Sometimes they're even blown up by mining companies. Sacred sites are extremely meaningful for First Nations peoples. They're some of the oldest sites of human occupation on the planet. But did you know there's no guarantee that ancient and sacred Indigenous sites in Australia won't be destroyed in future? Advocates say new laws being drafted about this in WA actually go backwards. So Tom Forrest and Serge Negus produced this story.
One of the rarest archaeological sites in Australia destroyed.
The traditional owners' concerns about the mining activity in the area couldn't be clearer. And yet late last month, two rock shelters at the 46,000-year-old site were obliterated by Rio Tinto.
Last year, the destruction of Juukan Gorge by mining company Rio Tinto sent shockwaves through the nation. How could a 40,000-year-old sacred site be reduced to rubble without the public knowing? And with traditional owners' concerns falling on deaf ears.
Rio Tinto is planning to expand their mine and this place will be lost.
We're good on my people are fighting for our country to protect and pass down what we can.
You can't say on the one hand, you know, you recognise the oldest living continuous culture on the earth and then go around blowing up all their sites.
Juukan Gorge raised an uncomfortable truth for Australia, that this wasn't a one-off event.
Well, despite the loud outcry over Rio Tinto's blasting of the Juukan Caves, the WA government has now approved the destruction of even more ancient Aboriginal sites.
Ben Wyatt, the WA Aboriginal Affairs Minister at the time, gave BHP permission to destroy at least 40 Aboriginal heritage sites to make way for its new $4.5 billion South Flank iron ore mine, only a few days after the destruction of Juukan. So why is this happening? We need mines and industry, but does development have to occur at the expense of heritage sites? Well, the West Australian government acknowledged at the time that their Aboriginal heritage laws were outdated.
I think there's a lot of soul searching going on. We'll make sure we bring forward new Aboriginal heritage legislation.
A federal inquiry into the destruction of Juukan Gorge even called on the West Australian government to stop approving the destruction of heritage sites until the new laws are passed. This hasn't happened. In fact, the West Australian government has approved the destruction of more sites. Another issue that these destructions raise is prosecution. Like in 2019, when the Gangan and Jawin sites, Moon and Serpent Dreaming areas, were destroyed by Kimberley Granite Holdings. The Kimberley Land Council said the destruction was illegal, and this year they pushed for the company to be punished, but the government chose not to prosecute. It infuriated traditional owners right at the time they were supposed to be consulting with Aboriginal Affairs Minister Stephen Dawson about the new legislation, something they say hasn't really happened.
This bill will favour the industry and government, and it doesn't favour us. So we want to be part of that decision-making from the start to the finish.
That's Anthony Watson, chairman of the Kimberley Land Council.
If you do support this legislation, you're supporting the government having final say and being able to destroy our Aboriginal heritage.
Anthony says that the new bill goes backwards and won't stop the destruction of sacred sites.
This draft law will not stop the ongoing destruction of Aboriginal cultural heritage, and it is a concern. The ministers say he can't guarantee that more sites like Juukan won't be destroyed again in the future. And these are things that we want to address, that we want guarantee, which he hasn't given us any guarantee.
Anthony is concerned that traditional owners will remain at a distance from the decision-making process when it comes to heritage sites.
It doesn't put us in a drawing at the centre towards making decision over our heritage. So all of that is a big no-no for us. That a lot of our rights has been making decision by other parties, by the industry and by government.
And it's not just the Kimberley Land Council. Yamaji Aboriginal Corporation in the Pilbara echo Anthony's worries about the bill.
They need to come back to the table, talk to the people around the Pilbara area, because our land's getting destroyed and we want to see a better heritage bill.
That's Doris Eaton, a highly respected Nyamu Pitjagali Nyangamata elder from the Pilbara region of WA.
They need to really sit down with the TOs from that area. They say they consult with prisoner lamas, but they're consulting with their prisoner lamas, not even from the area itself where you're going to have the impact on.
Dr. Joe Dorch is an archaeologist who researches heritage management. He also has some concerns about the draft bill.
It looks like that bill waters down what is already a weakened heritage regime. It looks like it basically facilitates development. It seems to be all about approvals, and that is approval to impact sites. It contains very little language about protecting or celebrating or commemorating heritage. So, it seems to be all about impacts and basically streamlining what we already have.
He also says that we need to look at the issue on a national level.
I think a lot of us are calling for a national standard on heritage. And there was an attempt made in the 1980s to introduce one. But that act is kind of in the background. It's rarely used. And I think it could be beefed up to create a national standard of what we expect about protecting our heritage.
Heritage is our living connection to our old stories. Heritage is not just a status and a building. Heritage is in our hearts.
Hack on Triple J.
Tom Forrest reporting there, and we put in a request to the WA government about this. They gave us a statement from the WA Aboriginal Affairs Minister Stephen Dawson. The spokesperson said the draft legislation was shaped through more than 100 workshops and information sessions attended by more than 1,400 people, 150 targeted and individual stakeholder meetings, and more than 380 submissions. It's also important to stress that the drafting of the bill is ongoing. The process is not yet complete. On the Triple J text line, someone says mining companies don't care. They'd rather blow it up and pay the comparatively small fine because they get enough revenue to be worth it. Well, let's talk a bit more about this with Jamie Lowe. He's a Gunjimara Jabwarong man and CEO of the National Native Title Council. Jamie, thanks so much for your time today. A lot of people will be listening and surprised to hear about sacred sites still being destroyed, the possibility of that happening in the future. How common is the destruction of sacred sites today?
Thanks for having me, and happy NAIDOC Week to everyone out there. And I guess the sad thing is, the simple answer is, it happens on an everyday basis. And Everyday basis in all jurisdictions. So I know your grab there was a focus on WA, but we know that in all jurisdictions, Victoria, South Australia, Queensland, wherever you travel, and the good and bad laws which, protect it or don't protect country are all inadequate. And the grab there also talked about a national standard, which is critical to further protect heritage.
Yeah, I'm keen to get to that in a sec. But, I mean, what impact does the destruction of a sacred site have on traditional owners? Is it describable?
It's pretty hard to describe the impact it has for that particular mob of that particular area. We have gone through all of us have gone through grieving processes when we've lost loved ones, et cetera. So, wouldn't directly compare it to that, but that's probably a comparison that I would use.
Yeah, right. And I mean, when we hear about sites being destroyed, I imagine there's not, I suppose, a typical scenario, but are they often being damaged because of willful ignorance, or is it miscommunication with traditional owners, accidents, or is it something else?
It's a combination of all of that. I guess the law allows for it, so that's one. It's a compliance thing. So it's not only it's a compliance thing where you get approval to destroy heritage. So that's one thing. There's sometimes lack of knowledge, lack of engagement with traditional owners. That's a thing. And sometimes it's pretty crude and they just know that it's there, but, they know what's under there as well, and they'll go ahead and, destroy it to get to the money.
Is there also someone texted in about fines and, big companies maybe not, needing to take that very seriously? Is that a big problem with incentives, not big enough fines, big enough repercussions and consequences?
Well, if you use the Drinking Gorge example, they'll get into $130-odd million worth of iron ore. At the current law, I think the fine's about $1 million. So you could argue that's a thing. There's no doubt about that. Even the new legislation talks about a $20 million fine, but if you're talking about $130 million and $20 million fine, you could ride the bump. So that could be a thing, but you hope that it's not. The laws need to be strong to actually run the prosecution case as well, and they need to have the appetite to do it.
You're listening to Hack on Triple J. I'm with Jamie Lowe from the National Native Title Council. Jamie, how would you like to see this issue be tackled? What's the most effective approach here? Is it certain states needing to tighten up their laws more than others? Or as we heard in that story, is it about setting a really meaningful national standard, which advocates say doesn't exist yet at the moment?
Well, I think it's both. I think WA is a big piece of the puzzle. It's such a large jurisdiction, a lot of activity happening over there, not only from the mining industry, but civil construction, etc. So this sits with the states, and the states need to actually further protect laws around cultural heritage, but the Commonwealth needs to step into it. So we've been working heavily with the Commonwealth, Minister Lees, Minister Wyatt, and they've been receptive to calls around the national standard, which will raise all jurisdictional standards to a benchmark of heritage protection.
Yeah, right. Really interesting. Well, it sounds like in all states and nationally, there's some appetite for change, at least on this. Well, Jamie, thanks so much for joining us today on Triple J to talk about it.
No problem.
That's Jamie Lowe there. He's the CEO of the National Native Title Council. We're already getting lots of texts about the vaccine rollout and the story about the private school boys getting vaccinated ahead of others. Keep those coming on 0439 757 555 and keep listening for that story coming up.
Hack. I know what I did. I know what I'm supposed to do. And I still made that decision.
On Triple J.
The fastest woman in America has had her Olympics dreams crushed because of weed. Sha'Carri Richardson tested positive for marijuana, which disqualified her for Tokyo. Yeah, even though you probably wouldn't think of it as a performance-enhancing drug, weed isn't allowed. What do you think of this rule? Text me 0439 75 7555. Today, Sha'Carri Richardson also lost her last chance to get on the US team because she could have competed in the American relay team but wasn't chosen. So, why is weed, a drug whose side effects usually include getting the munchies, chilling out, not allowed for elite athletes? Tracy Holmes is a sports reporter for the ABC. She's heading to Tokyo to cover the Olympics. Tracy, first of all, tell me about Sha'Carri Richardson. People might not have heard of her in Australia, but she's a huge deal in the US right now, isn't she?
Oh, she's absolutely huge, and she would have been, you know, huge internationally had she been allowed to go and compete in the race that she was tipped to win. As we know, the 100 metres race on the track at the Olympic Games is always the biggest. It carries the most notoriety, and she could have been up there with some incredible names that have won it in the past. But as you say, she tested positive, she's out, and the USA Track and Field Association decided not to pick her for the relays either, even though her ban would have finished well before that event.
Right, and that was because they'd already picked the team and they didn't want to take someone else's.
Well, it's spot, really interesting. Right? They actually said that, no, they hadn't. But what they did, they released a statement and they said that they were incredibly sympathetic towards Sha'Carri Richardson and the extenuating circumstances because she'd been informed that her, you know, mother had passed away, and that was part of the reason why she said she decided to have some weed. And they fully agreed that the international rules should be re-evaluated with marijuana being on the banned list. But even though they have that heartfelt understanding, they decided to pick two people below her, even though she's number one in the USA and would likely have been number one in the world.
Right, so we won't see her at Tokyo at all. Tracy, how did this, if we go back a bit, how this drug violation unfolded? Because my understanding was you had already qualified for Tokyo and then it got wound back because of this.
Yeah, because the positive test came back, and so that's what happens. They kind of annul any of the events that you may have been affected by at the time that you had this in your system, and so that's what happened with her. There's been lots of discussion about the fact that a lot of rules, you know, the whole anti-doping list needs to be re-evaluated. There are that many things on there that many people say, why? We don't even know what the performance-enhancing element is, although it has been watered down to a degree in that originally it was any trace of marijuana. Now there's a limit
right,
that you
sort
have to
measured.
Test positive to.
Yep.
Exactly.
You're listening to Hack on Triple J. I'm Ange McCormack with Tracy Holmes. We're talking about this story about Sha'Carri Richardson, the fastest female runner in the US, not being allowed to go to the Olympics because of testing positive to marijuana use. Tracy, I mean, a lot of, as you just mentioned there about the certain drugs that are on the list, I mean, a lot of us can understand why some aren't allowed, things that make you faster and stronger. Do we have an understanding of why weed is on there, why the World Anti-Doping Agency has banned that?
Well, there's three different ways that a substance can end up on the banned list. So one is, you know, about the health of the athlete. One is that it is, you know, dangerous. And the other element is that it goes against the spirit of sport. I've asked thousands of people to define that in my many years of doing this, and no one really can. But I think it's one of those sort of catch-all phrases. And so a lot of people have said that in this day and age, in 2021, what this is a moralistic argument. You know, having marijuana on there because you might be old-fashioned. I mean, you're talking about people that are racing and competing in the USA, where in many states it is now legal. There's been a whole lot of relaxation legally around marijuana. So how can it be that athletes can miss out on the biggest moment in their sporting career by testing positive to something that many argue should not be on there any longer? Some people do say, though, that if you suffer nerves and you get incredibly tense, it can be performance enhancing because it relaxes you heading into that moment.
Right. I suppose I could see that. And I suppose with this spirit of the sport thing, they don't want to be seen as endorsing drug use. Is that possibly part
exactly.
of the equation
yeah, that's,
there?
That's, yeah, that's part of it.
Yeah, they don't want to be supporting. Like, it's legal where she had it, where she used it. It's legal in lots of parts of the world, but they don't want to be, I guess, pro-weed use. It's such a funny one. On the Triple J text line, someone says, I'm so conflicted on this topic. She knew the rules and broke them, but at the end of the day, weed is not a performance enhancing drug. Tracy, like, what does the ruling say about WADA? You sort of touched on it there about how elite sports handle the issues of drug use in athletes today.
Yeah, it's really interesting because we've got a case at the moment with one of our swimmers, Shayna Jack, who tested positive to something, an extremely low trace amount of a banned substance that even the best experts in the world say it was such a low category that there's no way it could have been performance enhancing at all. Like, it was minuscule, irrelevant, they said. And yet here she is, you know, facing a 4-year ban herself. So there's a lot of pros and cons. It's anti-doping is fraught. It's a minefield. There are things on there that most people would have never heard of. Other things people test positive to that they had no idea where it came from. And because tests are getting better and better now, they're picking up smaller and smaller amounts of anything. So you have to be so incredibly careful about anything you touch, anything that goes into your system, because ultimately the athlete is responsible.
Tracy, the Tokyo Olympics have been really controversial. We're just over 2 weeks away. I mean, what's your sense of the general feeling over there? Is the city ready? What's the vibe?
The city doesn't want it.
Yeah.
The organising committee says they're ready. So they're kind of facing this real tug of war inside Japan itself. But lots of things. Every day there are new rules and regulations that are put into place. One of them being that the opening ceremony, closing ceremony will not have spectators. So the only people there to watch the athletes march in, that fantastic athletes parade that most people around the world tune into, will
be
in a predominantly
really
empty stadium.
Eerie feeling, yeah.
Very eerie.
Yeah.
And very austere.
Yeah, and we find out our Australian flag bearer tomorrow, is that right?
We find out tonight. We find out in 20 minutes.
Yeah, exactly. Well, looking forward to that. Tracy Holmes, thanks so much for filling us in, and good luck at Tokyo for reporting on it all. That's Tracy Holmes there. On the Triple J text line, someone says, I can't even string a sentence together if I smoke, let alone run a record time.
Hack. It's obscene. It's absolutely obscene, and it again highlights the inequality.
On Triple J.
Should we form an orderly line to get vaccinated and stick to the queue? Or is it a race? And if you can find a jab, go for it. Health authorities had to apologise for allowing more than 160 students from an elite private school in Sydney to get the Pfizer vaccine, even though most of them weren't eligible. It's raised questions again about how Australia's handling our vaccine rollout. It's an especially big issue in New South Wales, where lockdown's been extended and young people are getting hospitalised for COVID. Are you someone who wished you could get the vaccine like these private school boys? Let me know what you think. Call me 1300 055 36 or text me 0439 757 555. Joe Lauder gets us up to speed with this story and how the COVID outbreak's going in New South Wales.
We don't want to be in a situation where we are constantly having to move between lockdown, no lockdown, lockdown, no lockdown.
Yeah, unfortunately, the lockdown is being extended for another week for people in Sydney plus the Illawarra and Blue Mountains areas. There were 27 new cases reported in New South Wales today, and the state's Premier Gladys Berejiklian says it's still too many to open up.
Now, I can foreshadow overnight that we've had a number of cases, more than we would like to have seen. So I'm anticipating that tomorrow's number will be higher than what we've seen today.
We've been in this pandemic for over a year, and the authorities from all states love to say that it's not about the case numbers, but the story behind them. The New South Wales Chief Health Officer, Dr. Kerry Chance, says a lot of these people were still out in the community while they're infectious, and that's not a good story.
So only 13 of the cases were in isolation of the 27 cases throughout their infectious period.
Most of the early cases in this outbreak were in the Bondi and Eastern Suburbs areas, but that's now shifted to three areas in southwest Sydney.
Please stay at home. So if you're in those local government areas of Fairfield, Liverpool and Canterbury-Bankstown, please stay at home. Do not visit loved ones. If you have got enough food, don't leave the house at this time.
I think there was, as I said, complacency with the focus being on the eastern suburbs.
Carl Asfor is the mayor of Canterbury-Bankstown, which is one of those three areas with rising cases. He told ABC News that there needs to be a lot of work done to make sure their multicultural communities aren't left behind.
I think it's really hard for community leaders to get the message out because they're locked down effectively as well. So I really do need the Premier and the government to really push hard on their social media avenues with the ethnic communities we have, and not just the top three or four, but all of them. I think it's really important that all languages, all ethnicities are targeted and spoken to.
This outbreak's now passed 350 cases, and Dr. Chance says there are eight people under 35 who are in hospital with COVID.
Of the seven people in ICU, one is in their 30s. A bit of a wake-up call to young people.
If you're like me, you probably heard that and thought, yeah, cool, it is a wake-up call, but most under 40s haven't been able to get vaccinated yet. And at the press conference this morning, the New South Wales Health Minister Brad Hazzard again said that that's one of the reasons this lockdown is necessary.
I think it's safe to say that if we had had the supply that we wanted and we like or would have wanted, we wouldn't now be in this situation here in New South Wales.
We've talked a lot about how hard it is to get vaccinated if you're young and how there are issues with the rollout, like how only a third of aged care staff are fully vaccinated. And that's why people are so pissed off about the news that a private school in Sydney managed to get some students vaccinated. 163 Year 12 students at St Joseph's were given their first Pfizer shots in late May. Apparently, the school's Aboriginal students who board there were eligible to be vaccinated, but somehow all their Year 12 boarders got vaxxed. New South Wales Health says it was an accident.
So clearly there was an error, and I can understand the concern and sympathise with the anger in the community about that occurrence.
The Health Minister was asked today if that was an embarrassing mistake for his department to make, and he really wasn't happy about it.
What I find more embarrassing is that you would make that sort of question accusation against frontline health staff who work their butts off and who tomorrow will have achieved a million vaccinations into arms. You know what? The school intended it well, there was a mistake, and so what? It's happened. Out of a million vaccinations, move on.
Hack. Triple J. Joe Lauder reporting there. On the Triple J text line, Steph on Wurundjeri Country says, let's not confuse the issue. We can get upset about the privilege of private school boys jumping the queue for the vaccine, but the problem is the queue itself. The government has failed us. This is only a small example of a broken system. Let's talk more about this with Professor Nigel McMillan. He's an infectious diseases expert from Griffith University. Professor, on this story about the private school boys getting vaccinated, queue jumping, the health minister kind of brushed it off, as we just heard. Is it a big deal in your eyes? I suppose it's only, you know, 160 odd vaccines. It won't throw the rollout into chaos, but the principle of it?
Yeah, look, I think in the end, it's an error that was made clearly by the health staff. Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people are obviously at any age above 16 are eligible, as is anyone who has a pre-existing condition such as diabetes, severe obesity, those sorts of conditions. So clearly those people were able to be vaccinated. But yeah, look, this is an error. Small number of vaccines. I can see why people would be pretty unhappy about the whole situation. And it really talks to the fact that this constraint in supply, this twilight zone we're in right now between waiting for this large amount of supply to come in and then we're having these outbreaks, is really putting the spotlight on the whole vaccine rollout issues, and this is why people are really upset about it.
Yeah, and looking at New South Wales specifically, that's where the bulk of community COVID cases are right now. There's been a number of young people under 35 hospitalised for COVID. Considering that, should we change the rollout to protect young people? And if so, how should we do it?
I've certainly seen that suggestion that we should to concentrate on that. Look, I think the idea is that our most vulnerable get vaccinated first is the correct one, the phase 1A and B. The problem is we've kind of rolled into the next phase without even completing phase 1A and B. So there's still vulnerable people out there in disability, healthcare workers, for example, who haven't been vaccinated, nurses and the like. So it's really this situation where we've rolled through phases without completing them that I think are really confusing people. And we've got a sort of another whole set of issues around, you know, people who are walking up to vaccine clinics and getting vaccinated as well. That's certainly been an issue in my state of Queensland. And this is just confusing people tremendously about the rules. But ultimately, let's get the old people vaccinated and then concentrate on getting everyone else sorted.
To talk about containing the disease, which is obviously what we want to do, do you think New South Wales went hard and fast enough with their lockdown to fight Delta? And, you know, what should lockdowns look like when there's Delta in the community?
Yeah, look, I think New South Wales has always had a less stringent approach to these sorts of things than the other states. And hindsight's a wonderful thing. We know that if you go early on lockdown, you're going to shorten the amount of time there. And I think they probably triggered at about the right time. But look, I think the problem really is, in some ways, the lockdown itself hasn't been stringent enough. I've heard it referred to rather cruelly as mockdown. And that's, you know, when you look at some of the businesses that are open and you see some of the viewing on TV and the like, and the, you know, obviously the tremendous use of public transport in Sydney makes it an issue, is really it hasn't been as hard as perhaps other states. And so clearly the numbers say you can't ease off yet, because we really don't want this to be out and about in one state and, you know, really have them give up, because eventually the rest of the country will fall if that's the case.
Just some good news now, and we only have about a minute to recap this, but you and your colleagues have developed this antiviral treatment for COVID, a treatment, not a vaccine, and it looks really promising. Can you tell us about it and how effective it could be in humans?
Yeah, certainly. So we've got vaccines, but we need therapies. You know, we have people in ICU. So this is a gene silencing treatment. It targets the virus directly, and basically we get 100% survival in our mice, and we can't really detect the virus in the lungs.
So no deaths.
No deaths. And so this is something we want to move into clinical trial, hopefully within the next 6 months.
And would that like relate to, are you feel optimistic about that having the same efficacy in humans?
Yeah, we are. We think that'll work well. And we also note this will work against all varieties of the virus, past, present and future, because of the way we've designed it.
Hack on Triple J.
That was Nigel McMillan there. He's an infectious diseases expert from Griffith University. Thanks so much for listening today. If you've ever got a story idea you want to hear on Hack, let us know. Email hack@abc.net.au. I'll be back with more stories for you tomorrow.